Coming today on Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast.
Now, we should distinguish. There is another myth that's kind of closely related to this. And that is that if I go to court, that the judge is going to see everything bad about the other person and agree with me. You know, I always have this vision that the people are going to think, I'm going to get into the courtroom and the heavens are going to open up and the judge is going to go, oh my gosh, you poor thing. How have you been living like this? Okay, he or she should definitely walk naked in the streets with everyone yelling shame. And I, you know, you should have it all.
Yeah, shame.
And let me give you 100% of his paycheck and all of the assets. And can I give you more?
Welcome to Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast with Rebecca Zung and Susan Guthrie.
This is the place to hear other people's stories, to learn from the top experts in every related field, and to also have some fun, laugh, and hang with two girlfriends who are also top family law litigators.
And now we invite you to listen to today's show.
It's going to inspire you to transform and break free.
Welcome to today's podcast. Our topic today, mothers automatically get the kids and other divorce myths busted. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. So today we're going to be busting some of the biggest myths in divorce. As divorce attorneys, Rebecca, you know, you and I hear what people commonly believe happens in divorce. And, you know, often they are very wrong when they walk through the doors of our office. You know, and in fact, one of the biggest myths that we're going to talk about in this episode is that moms always get the kids in divorce. I think that's really, I hear that more than I hear almost any other statement from clients. And it's one of the first things that I need to disabuse them of that notion. So we're going to address that myth and many others.
Yeah, that one about the moms automatically getting the kids, that's one that we hear from both moms and dads. I mean, it's not just moms saying, well, I automatically must get the kids because I'm the mom. Dads often think that too. And I think it kind of is an old carryover because years and years ago, long before you and I started practicing law, if you can believe that, there was something called the tender years presumption. And that was a presumption. I don't know if it was in every state, but I know for sure it was in Florida, but I think there was something similar in every state, which basically said, hey, if the kids are little, they automatically are with mom most of the time. Dads would get every other weekend or, you know, that was where the old term weekend dad or Disney dad came about because dads were working, moms were at home. It was kind of a carryover from, you know, the old Leave It to Beaver paradigm of moms at home taking care of the kids and dads out working. And so therefore, if parents get divorced, then moms automatically get them. In Florida, and I know a lot of other states as well, in the last 10 years or so, there has been a push to remove language from the statutes that make one parent seem more important than the other. So they've removed terms like custody and primary residential parent and visitation. Kind of seems like you're visiting somebody in prison or something.
Yeah. So, not parenting your children.
Yes. And, you know, why is somebody visiting, you know, a parent, a child visiting their parent? And so what that has done is it's really, really shifted the way courts think about parenting. And there's now much more of a shift toward the 50-50 model or something close to it. I don't know if you've seen that as well, Susan.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, I have to say Connecticut and California, both of the states I've practiced in, have also both removed language, words like visitation. They've gone to parenting time and things like that. So certainly I don't see, you know, parenting plans that are really down and exactly to that 50-50, but I see shared parenting time almost in every case, where the parents are just, both of them have shared custody of their children. And then the parenting plan, I've always found, is really more a practical matter of what works best for that family. You know, when the parents are available, when they have time to parent.
Oh, and you and your voice of reason.
Yeah. Why be practical about it?
Why must you be so reasonable? I mean, you know, no, I must have 50-50 because he or she cannot have more time than I do. You know, I mean, that's sometimes it comes down to, you know, you can't let the other one get away with something, or you can't let them win, even if it's not necessarily what's best for the child. But I agree with you. But I have seen people say, you know, well, I pick them up at noon, so I get them at noon. And if I'm picking them up at 2 o'clock, then I need 2 hours of makeup time, you know.
Yeah, makeup time.
I have seen that too, but that's another whole show.
Yeah, makeup time could be a show all by itself.
Yes, that's another whole show. another myth around children is that if the other person doesn't pay their child support, that then the other parent can deny visitation or custody time or shared parenting time. Oh, well, he hasn't paid, so he doesn't get to see the kids. That there's this big myth that somehow they're intertwined.
Yeah, that the two have something to do with each other. And it's always a shock, I think, to the parent who feels they're the custodial parent, that you do not get to say you don't get to see your children if you're not paying child support. In fact, I know Connecticut has a statute that very specifically says that the two have nothing to do with each other, and that the one parent can not deny the other parent their custodial time as a result of the non-payment.
And by the way, the reverse is true too. If the other parent has been denying your parenting time, you don't get to say, well, then I'm not paying.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, you always pay your child support.
Yes, you still have to pay.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem fair, I understand, but you know, the two seriously just have nothing to do with each other in the eyes of the law. They're just two totally separate areas of the law.
Really, the clients need to know that, and they need to know if you are not getting your parenting time, you need to address that in a motion or in some fashion with the court, or go back to mediation over that issue. And if someone's not paying their child support, completely separate issue, also needs to be addressed through the court. Or most states, or actually I think all states, do have a child support enforcement division where you can basically go to the state, and the state will pursue the non-paying parent. But neither, and those courts, the support enforcement courts, are not going to deal with your custody or your parenting time issues.
Right. And the other thing to remember is that the courts, the judges, they don't look kindly on people who take justice into their own hands. And so down the road, if you end up in front of the judge and you say, well, I didn't pay my child support because I wasn't getting my time sharing, or conversely, I didn't give time sharing because I wasn't getting my child support, the courts will maybe hold that against you, and there may be a punitive measure that is taken because of that. So you don't want to put yourself in that position.
Yeah, no, I've definitely seen that. I've seen judges get very touchy on that very, very same subject.
Yeah. And you know, the flip side of that is that if you continue to pay your child support, even if you're not getting to see the kids, or you continue to, you know, make sure the other parent has their time sharing, even if they're not paying support, then you look like the good client, the good person, the better party, the person who took the higher ground, and that should serve you if you end up in front of a judge.
And that's really a truth that I've always found comes through on those cases where you do end up in front of a judge. A judge is never of a mindset where you both come in with dirty hands and you know, one of you did something wrong, so it was okay for you to do something in violation of the court's orders. It never comes out well for you, and you are always in better shape if you walk into the court with that clean, I always call it the clean hands, be the one with the clean hands who's done the right thing. But putting aside what a judge thinks or what a judge is going to do, you know, do the right thing for your children. And although you may think that, oh, I'm not getting my child support, therefore that other parent is a bad parent and my children shouldn't see them, that's not really the truth. In almost all cases, the children should have access to both their parents.
Now, we should distinguish. There is another myth that's kind of closely related to this. And that is that if I go to court, that the judge is going to see everything bad about the other person and agree with me. You know, I always have this vision that the people are going to think, I'm going to get into the courtroom and the heavens are going to open up and the judge is going to go, oh my gosh, you poor thing. How have you been living like this? Okay, he or she should definitely walk naked in the streets with everyone yelling shame. And I, you know, you should have
Game
it all.
Of Thrones. Yeah, shame, shame.
Shame, shame. And let me give you 100% of his paycheck and all of the assets. And can I give you more? Is there a way I could give you more? Yeah, that's another myth.
That's a big myth. I have had that conversation with many a client where they feel like in the negotiations, they're not getting what they want. And so we'll just go to court. And I always, that's exactly the conversation we have. You cannot believe that in a courtroom, first of all, you don't just walk into a courtroom, open your mouth and just say whatever you want to say to a judge and just tell your story. There are rules of evidence. There's a process and procedure as to what's admissible and what's not. And the judge doesn't have all day to just sit there and let you just ramble on about, you know, all that you feel that they need to know. So it's not.
Oh, yeah. And plus it costs thousands of dollars for your lawyer to even get prepared to get there to present your case in the first place.
And they put on your case, and never forget the other side's going to have an opportunity to do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's never going to be the same story you're telling.
Well, and it just ties into what I say about divorce law versus divorce justice. I mean, the court, the judge can only apply the law. That's it. That's their role. Their role is to interpret the law and apply it. That is a judge's role. I mean, they are to look at the facts and apply the law to the facts as they see them. And right. So they cannot go beyond the scope of the law. They will be in error. It is appealable if they do that.
Judges don't go rogue.
No, they can't. They're sworn not to. So, you know, this whole idea of justice will be served, which means your version of justice, whatever you think that should be, will not be what you think it's going to be. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, the common thing is it's the principle of the matter.
Yeah.
That's
not fair. I should win.
So, Rebecca, you know, another myth that I run into all the time is when it comes to how assets are titled or how property is titled. And people always think that if that bank account is in my name alone, or if the house is solely titled to me, then the other person, your spouse, has no interest in it, that it's non-marital and you get to keep it. And that's a big myth, because it really doesn't matter in any state that I know of how the title to the property is held. There's so much more that goes into the analysis, but the presumption initially is that, at least in Connecticut, I know, everything is on the table until you can separate it out, whether it be titled solely in your name or it's jointly titled.
Yeah. So I always say you look at the nature and character of the asset, like how was it acquired? What funds were used to acquire it? I had a guy come into my office one time who thought he was so smart. He had taken an equity line off the marital home that was in both names, and he had gone out. It was like before 2005, you know, like back when they were making all this money on real estate, and he had bought 10 or 12 other homes using the equity line on home as a down payment. And then, of course, he'd been servicing the mortgages and everything else with his earnings. So those properties, but he had put them all in his own name.
Yeah.
They were all in his own name.
And she can't have those.
She can't have those. Well, when I had to tell him that all of them were marital, 100%, he was not a happy camper. But, you know, that's the way it goes. So especially if assets are acquired during the marriage, they're definitely going to be presumed marital unless you can prove otherwise. Yeah. So, I mean, unless you can trace out that they were attached to some inheritance that wasn't ever commingled or some premarital asset or premarital account, you're just even half over. So,
well, and often that tracing that you're talking about can cost you thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Forensic accountant, or it requires gathering statements going back to the original
1904.
Yeah, that who has their statements from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And very often it'll cost you more to try and trace that back than you're going to be able to exclude from the
Yes. Map. Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's a very good point. I say that all the time. Like, are you going to get back more than this is going to cost you? Because, you know, if the return on your investment is, you know, the same amount it's going to cost you to
or less
out, then maybe not worth it.
No. Keep in mind, you're paying your attorney for all of that time to do that, you know, go through the process of tracing that back for you as well. So, not just the forensic accountant.
Right. And then you have to make sure there's no holes in that tracing because, you know, if there's one statement that's missing or one piece that's a big hole, you can't assume, well, it's just obvious. Isn't it obvious that this money came from here and went into there? No.
Obvious doesn't work in a courtroom too well either.
No, the judge has to have actual facts and evidence that, you know, that they can hang their hat on and say, I'm making my decision based on this.
Yeah.
So, no assumptions allowed.
Coming up, more from Susan and Rebecca on Mothers Automatically Get the Kids and Other Divorce Myths Busted.
So, and now my favorite of all as a divorce attorney.
Uh-oh.
Take a listen to our archive where you can hear Susan and Rebecca discuss more divorce topics in depth, such as bet you didn't know that adultery can bite you in the ass, even in a no-fault state.
What, was she much younger?
She was significantly younger. And he was, you know, very certain at the time he was spending all this money that this was his, you know, new intended life mate. But what it is,
he thought that she, you know, and I think that she thought that she went very well with his wallet.
Yes, very good.
It was a match made in heaven.
We apologize for the audio technical difficulties with this episode. They were unforeseeable and will not be an ongoing issue for future episodes. Thank you for listening.
And now we return to today's show.
That makes me think of another assumption that I run into all the time when it comes to support matters, you know, alimony or spousal support or child support. And people often think that those are based on need or past spending or, you know, lifestyle expenses, and then are shocked when they find out that this is all my alimony is going to be, or this is all I'm getting for child support, but we live in such and such a town. Do they know what it costs to raise a child here? They don't care. It doesn't have anything to do with
you. No, especially child support, because that's a guideline in every single state. So that the guideline gets applied, and that is that. And
that's just a formula, right?
It's a formula in every single state. Yeah. And you know, what goes into that formula is, you know, basically, you know, consumer goods kind of a thing. It's what does it cost to put food on this child's table? And basically clothe and put a roof over their head. It really has nothing to do with, you know, expensive field trips, dance, travel, baseball, all those kinds of extra things that we know goes into having children. And it really doesn't count cell phones, car insurance, all these things that you know, those are all extra. Yeah. So often
those, I mean, maybe what I think is a surprise for clients is that something that needs to be negotiated in addition to child support in many cases. I mean, many of the settlement agreements do contain language or an agreement about how those expenses will be shared. But I've had child support payors say, well, I pay child support, why do I have to kick in toward that field trip to Washington, D.C.,
right,
or that sort of thing? Or on the flip side, you know, where mom's like, or whoever's receiving the child support is like, well, this doesn't even pay for the car payment and the mortgage payment. What about the rest of raising a child?
Right. So hand in hand with that is another big myth that I hear, which is that, hey, we're doing 50-50, so I shouldn't have to pay child support at all.
Yeah, that's a common one.
Yeah. And I have to tell them, well, it doesn't have anything to do with, well, I mean, it does have something to do with time sharing in certain states, but it also has to do with incomes. And so, you know, if you're making $500,000 and the other spouse is making $50,000, you're probably going to be paying child support.
Yeah. I know certain states do have, you know, so in California, the percentage of time that the children are with each children is a part of that calculation that you were referring to earlier, the guideline.
Same in Florida.
Yeah. Connecticut doesn't have that aspect. But
and I believe New York is also, it's just like a straight 17% or something like that is what I've heard. But don't quote me on that, but I've heard that they have a straight percentage of some sort. So each state is a little bit different, but you know, all of the states that we've mentioned, none of them have, well, it's 50-50, no child support.
Right.
I don't think any state has that.
You might vary from the guidelines a little bit if you have that equal sharing parenting time, but...
Well, if there's equal... if there's equal sharing and equal incomes, there may not be child support.
Right. But if you've got those disparate incomes, you're usually going to see a child support payment from one to the other.
Right. And because remember, the child support is a right of the child. And that's something that people really, really don't understand. It is not a right of the parent. It is a vested right of the child. And so that's actually comes to another myth that we have, which is that, oh, I'm just going to sign off. I'm going to have him sign off on his rights because I don't want him to see the child anyway, and I don't want his child support.
Right. And the state doesn't necessarily look at it that way, does it? I mean, if he's willing to sign off on his rights, that might happen. But you, as the recipient of child support, don't have the ability to waive it. It belongs to the children, as you just said. And so parents can't say, no, you just keep that money. I don't want it. It needs to be paid. The court's going to make an order about that. They don't want, you know, there's a vested interest in the part of the judge, who, remember, is an arm of the state, to make sure that the children don't become wards of the state or recipients of support through public funds. So you will almost never see a complete waiver of child support except in very, you know, specific circumstances.
Yeah, the only time I've ever seen that go through is if there's a step-parent adoption. In other words, where they can say, well, okay, we're substituting out somebody else who's going to be responsible for this child, so therefore we'll go ahead and allow the other person off the hook.
Right.
But without that, I've never seen it allowed.
I've seen cases where a judge has allowed the support to be set at zero or an amount less than the guidelines called for, but it's usually where some other financial consideration is being made by the parent who's not going to be paying support.
Right. Well, that's definitely true, but that's only if the guidelines support that.
Allow for deviation.
Yes.
Yeah. One thing to note, though, when we talk about the fact that child support is a right of the children, another myth that I've heard along the way is that the children then think it's their money. I've had children who have come to me who are now adults who say, well, you know, my dad or my mom never paid their child support while I was growing up, so I want to file a suit against them to get my child support. And although it's the right of the child to receive those funds, the child has the right to participate in the parents' incomes. It's not money that the child is entitled to have in their hands.
It really, I think it depends on the state. In Florida, they can come back up to 2 years after they are emancipated.
Is that emancipated before they turn 18?
Assuming it's usually that they've turned 18 at that point.
Okay. All right.
So once they've become 18, they can do it up to 2 years and get... Yeah. So I actually litigated one of those one time. I mean, the mother came forward and was the one driving it, but because she wanted to get the money back for the daughter's college, but the case was filed in the daughter's name.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
None of the states I've practiced in have that action.
Yeah. So if you're in Florida, beware. We have a couple of other myths. We'll save the best for last. But a couple of other ones are that if there's a good property settlement, then that means there's automatically no support.
No alimony?
Alimony, yeah.
Spousal, yeah.
Spousal support, yeah. Especially guys think that if they're the moneyed spouse, they'll think, well, she's getting $2 million in assets. She definitely won't, you know, why should she have alimony? She has plenty of money.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily what it's based on. They're totally separate areas of the law. You know, it could be that if the property that is received throws off some passive income, that would be counted toward income, which would reduce the alimony or spousal support, but not always, you know?
Right. So it's a nuanced conversation, I think, when you get to that particular issue. The one thing that I think, you know, using your example, she gets $2 million, but she's not expected to then use her $2 million to live. If there's money, it's invested or it's in a rental property and she received income from that rental property or something like that. I've certainly seen that be used as part of the equation on the recipient side of the fence as they have some income. But if you still have, I always find it comes down to that question of disparate incomes again, where if the payor or the person giving the larger settlement or feeling that they're giving the large settlement is making a vastly larger amount than the recipient of the property settlement, you can still see a sizable alimony or spousal support award.
Right, right. But, you know, that brings up another myth that I just thought of, which is, you know, that somehow people think that they're going to be entitled to the person's income after they're divorced. You know, well, he's going to get to keep all of his income and he's going to get his bonuses, but I contributed to his career. Why shouldn't I continue to share in that, even though we're not married anymore? Well, you know, how you share in it is if you're eligible for some sort of support award. That's your
right.
share.
Yeah. Some states allow that to go up and down, you know, your spousal award to go up and down as the payor's income goes up and down. Other states like California here, there's kind of a threshold where your marital standard of living, so what your standard of living is while you were married, sort of sets the top amount of what you might receive. So if your spouse after the divorce goes out and starts earning a lot more money or has a lot of good things happening, you as the recipient of support are probably not going to participate in that.
Right, exactly. So, and another myth is that you can prevent someone from divorcing you. Well, I just won't sign off on the papers.
Yeah. They served me with papers, but I didn't sign them.
I don't want to be divorced, so I just won't sign off on it.
Yeah. That's a hard one to explain to people because it's, you know, they're very emotional around this topic or subject. It's more common than not, I would say, that one of the parties is driving the divorce and wants the divorce. The other one is usually lagging somewhere behind on that spectrum of desire to get a divorce. And with no fault, which we have in every state, it's not up to, all it takes is one of the parties saying, I don't want to be in this marriage anymore for a divorce to happen.
Yeah. Um, No judge is going to make someone stay married to someone if they don't want to be.
Yep.
So, I mean, I stood there one time back in the days and you know, certain states, in certain jurisdictions, you have to show up for the final hearing, even if it's uncontested. And I remember standing at an uncontested final hearing one time, and the judge said, you know, do you both agree that your marriage is irretrievably broken? And the one party said yes, and the other one said no. And the judge just went, signed the final judgment, and moved on.
Yep. Did it
How
make
was that?
I had a very similar case where one of the parties said, no, I think we should go to counseling. And the judge said, do you, sir, think you should go to counseling? He said, no. And that was the
that
end
was
of that,
that
conversation.
Next.
Yeah, and it's not fun. I mean, it was hurt. It was upsetting for the person, I know. But
of course.
It's a fact of how... You know, really the process has been set down to such a point where it really is that if one of you wants out, the divorce is going to happen. The only question is how you're going to divide your stuff up and what the support, if any, is going to be. And if you have children, what the custodial arrangements look like. It's not whether or not you're going to get a divorce.
No. No, it's not, unfortunately, for the people who don't want the divorce. Yes.
Yeah.
So, and now my favorite of all is a divorce attorney.
Uh-oh.
How are they getting away with this?
It's not fair. How is this all happening?
It's not fair.
Yeah.
How is he or she getting away with all of this? You know, do something.
Yeah, so, we're the police, or we're the divorce police.
Yeah, so I every time I hear that, I think, so are there like little divorce police gremlins like that show up like genies in your living room? Hey, you're not allowed to be doing that. Get back to where you're supposed to be.
Somebody walks in with your divorce decree in their hands and points to page 12. You can't do that. It says it right here.
Yeah, or even before the divorce decree, you shouldn't be taking the kids now. That's wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I go back to my premise of the only person that has any power over anyone else at all in a divorce case is the judge. Period. And the only power is through the power of making orders. And the only way you can get to having an order is by filing motions, setting them for hearing, going and doing the hearing, and then waiting for the judge to make a ruling via the order. And that does not happen instantaneously.
No, the only way to do it quickly is come to an agreement, put it in writing, and get a judge to sign off on it.
Yes. Yes. If you have a case that's open, I mean, a lot of times people are saying, hey, how is he or she getting away with this? And you don't even have a case that's open.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's really no gremlins running around divorce police that, you know, before you file, you know, you need to at least have a case open so that you have somebody to run to ask for something to happen.
Right. You can't just walk into the court and the judge is going to listen to you if you don't have a case and you're not on the docket.
Yes.
You'd be scheduled for that day.
Right. And it takes, there is a time lag between, and by the way, the whole idea of an emergency motion, well, it's an emergency. File for and ask for an emergency hearing. So the judges want to make sure that, you know, somebody is about to be killed.
Yeah.
Blood is involved.
Removed from the country imminently.
Yeah. Really, really exigent circumstances is the, you know, very emergency, real emergencies, not, you know, he dropped off the kids with no clothes and now I have to go to Target and buy clothes for the weekend. I had that one time.
Yeah.
I had to remind the person that the phone call to me was costing more than clothes at Target. For the weekend. And the other thing is that we as lawyers don't have, or mediators or anybody like that, do not have that immediate power. You know, I've had people say to me, you've done nothing to control his behavior. Okay, well, I filed motions and we set them for hearing. that's what I've done.
Right.
That is the extent of my power.
Yes, as we were talking about earlier, our law degrees did not come with a magic wand or a crystal ball. So
I wish they had.
No magic. I know, that cape would be really.
Really, would have made it so much easier. Darn.
Yeah, there's no magic in any of it.
No, I had one woman one time where the parties at a temporary mediation had agreed in writing that he was going to move out on a certain day and he was going to take certain furniture with him. Well, he shows up with the movers and he starts loading all kinds of extra furniture on the moving van that he's not allowed to take. So I'm in another mediation at the time and I get a frantic call from her saying, he's taking more than he's supposed to. I jumped on the moving van. I'm on the moving van now and it's pulling away. You need to stop him right now. Yeah. I was like, well, let me get on my cape.
Yeah. Or broom, depending on.
Broom, could be broom.
He might have been thinking that.
Mighty Mouse, here I come to save the day. I'll be rushing over there and stopping that moving van with my bare hands.
You need to do your Wonder Woman thing out.
Yes. That's right. Get in my invisible plane. That's what I would have done. I didn't think of that. Why didn't I think of that? So we kid and laugh, but the serious thing is that it may seem like the other person is getting away with stuff, but just remember that there is a process to it. Unfortunately, it is not immediate. There's no instant gratification in this process. And in the end, hopefully, justice will be served, but it will be justice according to the laws of your state, unless you can agree to something different in mediation.
And often it's not the justice that you think, it's the justice that the system provides for you, and it's definitely justice delayed.
Yeah, so just like the old myths we heard as kids, like don't cross your eyes because they'll get stuck that way, or if you eat too many carrots, you'll turn orange.
Yeah, realize there are divorce myths as well, and consider the source of your information and make sure you're making your decisions from facts and not myths. And that brings up a good point. You know, if you're looking for hard information, good information on divorce and the laws and how the process works, Rebecca has a wonderful program, Breaking Free from Divorce. We'll put some information about her program in our show notes, but I highly recommend that if you're going to get some information about divorce, you might consider starting there.
Thank you for joining us today on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce Podcast. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. For a limited time, get your free copy of Rebecca's best-selling divorce book, Breaking Free, a step-by-step divorce guide to achieving emotional, physical, and spiritual freedom at www.breakingfreethebook.com.
And for your free copy of Susan's Top 10 Reasons to Mediate Your Divorce, visit www.divorceinabetterway.com.
Check back next Monday for our next edition of our powerful, inspirational, and educational podcast. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please remember to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and let us know what you liked in a review.
And remember, you're just one step away from your new life.